Welcome to Still Scared Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky, and disturbing children's books, films, and TV. I'm Ren Wednesday, my co-host is Adam Wybray, and today we're talking about the 2017 CBBC series, Creeped Out. A full transcript of this episode will be available, so check the show notes for that. Enjoy! Hi, Adam.
Hello, hello.
So we're coming up to the modern day in this one after tooling around in the 80s and 90s quite a bit. This Creeped Out is from last year, so...
Hey, kids, we're bang up to date. Like Steve Buscemi in that meme.
Yeah, that's us. Yeah, pretty excited to talk about this because you watched it when it was on.
Yeah, and it was the kind of thing I thought had gone forever from the television. Like, you know, I know there's Doctor Who and such, but like I guess like maybe I should have guessed that with anthology shows coming back into fashion, like with Black Mirror and Inside Number 9, that there would be something like this for kids, but it just totally kind of blindsided me, and yeah, I thought it was great, really thrilling, really ghoulish, and with some genuinely nice twists. Like, it brought back what I really like about Goosebumps or Are You Afraid of the Dark, but obviously with much better production values, and some really great cinematography as well.
So it's, yeah, as you said, it's an anthology show, made, between Britain and Canada. So some episodes are filmed in Britain and some in Canada. They each tell a different story, but they're linked by a masked character called The Curious, who appears at the beginning of each episode, has a sort of object that's related to the story, and, his whistle is said to indicate that something creepy is about to happen.
And his face is obscured by a smooth clay mask.
Yeah. It's sort of... Yeah.
Kind of like if a kid had to try to make their own hockey mask at home.
Yeah.
And just had, like, some paper mache or clay or something. And
yeah,
they went
yeah,
to school when everyone was kind of creeped out by them.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the reveal, you know. We don't know who The Curious is. So if there's another season, as I'm very much hoping there is, you know.
Yeah.
There's a potential story for them.
Maybe that's how he came into existence.
Yeah.
The protagonists are sort of, I guess, sort of between about 13 and 17, I guess.
Yeah, a range of teenage characters, yeah.
And, yeah, it's very cool and creepy and, yeah, I really like it.
Yeah, I think this one both gets our thumbs up. I really loved it.
So how many episodes were there in this series?
There were 13 episodes, appropriately. But the season was split into two parts. So there was a bit of a break at the end of the year and then finished off in the new year, basically.
So Adam sent me a list of his favourite ones to watch. So Adam's seen all of them and I've just seen the the selected highlights. Yeah, and still possibly too many to talk about, but we'll...
Yes, we'll try to cover all the bases, at least very briefly, but we're going to focus on a select few. And it's worth noting that the series is created by Bede Blake and Robert Butler, and they generally, as a writing pair, but occasionally individually, wrote all the episodes except for episode 10, Shed No Fear, which was written by Dennis McGrath, which I did think had a slightly different tone to it than the other episodes. It was more of a kind of sci-fi adventure. It felt more like a kind of Spielberg thing from the 80s, which is nice in its own way and quite charming. But yeah, it felt tonally, I thought, quite different to the other ones, which makes sense when I then found out that Butler and Blake did write all the other episodes.
Yeah. So shall we start at the beginning?
Sure, with Slapstick.
Yeah, episode one, Slapstick, which, I don't know, hits all my buttons. I love... Because it has puppets in it.
Well, we both love creepy puppets. Did you watch it with Bert?
Oh, I should have. Bert's my... Bert is a puppet that Adam made for me, who has a head made out of a coconut and a little floral dress. Bert's lovely. I'm sure he would have enjoyed it.
Yeah. Well, maybe he would have been a bit upset by the puppet representation.
It's true. It's not...
So do you want to... what's it about?
So Slapstick is a kind of classic kind of be careful what you wish for episode. So Jessie, who's about 13, is really embarrassed by her parents, who are quite like loud and boisterous and have fun in a sort of way that she finds incredibly embarrassing. So they kind of embarrass her in front of the cool girls that she wants to impress. So she storms off and sits down on the beach where there's a puppet show happening. And it's afterwards, the boy who's collecting the money says, "Oh, someone wants to speak to you." And she goes up and it's a puppet. It's Mr. Blackteeth, who is...
not a dentist.
No, not a dentist.
But not a dentist by any means.
No. He's sort of wearing a suit and a cravat and it's sort of pale face and dark eyes and wild hair.
He's quite sort of rakish in his way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Reminds me of like Edward Carswell of the legendary Pink Dots, actually.
And he has a proposition for her, which is that she can make her parents do whatever she likes. And all she has to do is knock on her head 3 times and say, "That's the way to do it." So she does. And he sort of laughs maniacally and she sort of runs back. And she goes back to her parents. And the next day, she finds that her parents have become like puppets and just do what she tells them to do.
So in a way, the plot's like an inverted Big Kids. Do you remember the programme Big Kids? It was on a little bit after our childhoods. My younger brother and sister watched it.
Oh, okay. No, I didn't see it.
Okay, so it was about this family who goes to a hypnotist, and basically there's a trigger word, or words, which over the course of the series, the two kids have to work out. But the idea is that this trigger word, the two parents revert to being children.
Oh, okay.
And start acting very immaturely and chaotically, and, you know, the kids have to be on their lookout and sort things out. So, in a way, it's a sort of inversion of that formula, in as much as the parents at first are very silly and chaotic and embarrassing, and then actually our protagonist, Jesse, played by Sydney Wade, wants the parents to be more adult, right? She wants them to be more sensible.
So she gets them to come to the party of the most popular girl, whose parents are very polished and sort of the opposite of hers.
Equipped, capable, connected.
And her parents just sort of do what she's told them to do, which is just have this sort of rictus grin whenever anyone talks to them. And sort of in the kind of tradition of the, you know, be careful what you wish for sort of episode, she realizes that she doesn't. This isn't actually what she wants, you know, her parents just being expressionless and robotic.
Just automatons for her desires. Yeah.
There's one of the creepiest moments possibly of the series is when Jessie gets tired of her parents being puppets and says, you know, oh, just go back to how you go back to how you were. And they both turn to her in unison and say expressionlessly, and how do we go back to how we were? But then there's kind of this further horror that it doesn't reverse after Jessie's learned her lesson, is that she goes to find Mr. Blacktooth again, and in order to reverse this, she has to find understudies. Okay, so her parents have become the puppets in the puppet show. So they're now performing the Punch and Judy, and she has to entrap a new teenager who's embarrassed by their parents to do the same thing that she has done and find understudies to take the place of her parents in the puppet show.
In a presumably infernal cycle.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's quite a cruel twist.
It is, yeah.
It's not just enough that she learns her lesson, that there's a kind of malevolence to the fact that despite having learned her moral lesson, she's then morally implicated into this maniacal puppet scheme. Yeah. So, you know, she ends up really being in the position of being puppeteered, at least, like, morally, by the puppet. in a sense, it reminds me, have you read any Thomas Ligotti?
No.
He's, I don't always like him. Sometimes he's a bit clever. But he's an adult horror writer, and he uses puppets a lot in his stories as, I guess, embodied representations of humans not having free will, essentially. So I think he sees humans as just being these sort of hollowed out vessels that see themselves as being self-determining but aren't actually. And this kind of struck me as being like Thomas Ligotti for kids, basically. that you can't escape the machinations of power, basically. that she ends up being kind of ensnared in this awful system at the end.
Yeah.
just the fact that it offers kind of no hope and no get-out clause, I think, for the first episode of a new kids TV show is pretty gutsy.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you might expect that it'd overthrow Mr. Blacktooth, but no. his scheme goes on uninterrupted.
So was there anything else that you found sort of unexpected about the episode? Like, did you have certain expectations going into Creeped Out? As the representative of, this is what this series is going to be like. You know, how did you find it?
I think it sort of lived up to my expectations. I was hoping for creepy stories, and I got them. So, I was interested in how it used technology, or the stories around technology and how it incorporated that.
I think that's, you know, you got to meet kids where they're at. Like, I keep struggling with this. Obviously, I don't teach kids, you know, I'm teaching undergrads, but with the first years, you know, 18, 19. And I've noticed that, you know, I teach film and they have very different viewing habits to what I'm used to and what, you know, I have or had when I was younger, that some of them just don't go to the cinema or haven't gone to the cinema for years, and they watch films on their phone or on a tablet. And generally the way they watch things is they, you know, and this is a generalisation, but a lot of them, yeah, watch things while having one eye on a game, one eye on the programme, or while texting. And at first, you know, I found this quite frustrating. I was like, you know, I didn't want them to look at their phones, but I've tried to kind of accept the fact that they engage with media in a different way. You know, and that is what it is. So I'm trying to write a module at the moment called Not Going to the Cinema, which is all about, say, the fact that that's not how most young people take in media anymore, you know. I like the fact that it was trying to do that, and it didn't feel like two old fuddy-duddies, you know, lecturing the kids about the dangers of internet addiction. So did you want to talk about Marty, which is...
That does seep into Marty, which sort of seems like it might be a kind of story about the perils of technology and spending too much time looking at your phone, but actually that's not where the horror really ends up coming from at all.
I'd agree for that. You know, at first you think it's Black Mirror for kids, but I think it's... Yeah. I think it's actually doing something more interesting and more sophisticated than that.
So in Marty, this is one of the Canadian ones. So the high school age protagonist, Kim, wants to become more popular. So she orders a new phone, but it has these capabilities that are sort of beyond anything she could have imagined. And it has this AI helper called Marty, who sort of quickly boosts her social status by composing texts and posts and things for her, getting her into the clique. But after a while, his sort of interventions become, it sort of definitely starts to take on a personality as he begins to sort of control Kim's life, sort of with threats that he'll destroy her newfound popularity if she doesn't sort of go along with sort of treating Marty as her boyfriend, essentially.
Yeah, she's sort of coerced into taking Marty to the prom and has to dress him up in a little tuxedo. A tiny phone tuxedo.
So Marty won't let her talk to another boy. So at the school, and she tries to destroy the phone, but it's it can't be destroyed. Which leads to another evocatively horrible line, which is, I can't be broken, Kim, but you can. so she she leaves at the school dance, she leaves the phone in the bathroom and to get a dance with the boy that she likes, but Marty ends up taking revenge by sort of airing all her friends' sort of dirty laundry in public, and and then it sort of takes her old friend, who she's sort of sidelined, to tell her to that now sort of Marty has no power over her because he's done what he was threatening to, and you know, destroyed her social standing. So she pushes the phone into some wet concrete and entombs Marty.
Yes.
Outside the school.
Although there's a slightly sickie-making twist at the end. Right?
Hmm.
That Marty is still being visited.
Yeah, she still sometimes kneels down to talk to him in the
concrete. It's a little, a little bit like in The League of Gentlemen, where her lip buries teenage boys in the soil, and they're left with breathing, like a breathing tube.
Okay.
You see him come back to Royston Basie and kneel down over the soil, whispering to the boy entombed. they didn't do this, but they said that originally they planned in the third season for him to go to like a sort of a field or a park, and there just to be all of these tubes you know, sticking out of the ground. I mean, I guess this is something that goes back to Edgar Allan Poe, right?
Hmm.
Entombed alive. I mean, you know, it's hard to say whether Marty would get claustrophobic, you know, is it?
yeah.
But so for you, this wasn't really about the perils of technology.
No, I think it definitely evolved very much into being about abusive relationships.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
So... yeah, Marty becoming increasingly controlling and coercive and isolating Kim and not allowing her to talk to boys or anything that he disapproves of.
And I think really this shows the power of allegory, or allegory at its best, because I think, you know, a lot of programmes... say, you know, like Hollyoaks, and you know, I think Hollyoaks is actually surprisingly good for progressive issues. Like, you know, my sister loves Hollyoaks, so I've watched a fair amount of it, and it's often surprised me by how decent its politics are.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very heavy-handed, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the danger with soaps or programs like Grange Hill or Biker Grove, kids feel like they're being lectured at, potentially.
Mm.
And also, it's kind of, in a way, it's easier to recognise things on screen when you got these characters and these character archetypes. And so you might see a character you know and you know you've spent time with, and something like Grange Hill, getting into an emotively abusive relationship. And you might potentially think as a child viewer, oh, well, you know, that's them, that happens to their character, but you wouldn't be able to square that with yourself, necessarily.
Mm.
Whereas I think something allegory is very good at doing is because it doesn't do that in the same way, you know, because it's clearly not just something that could happen as is. There's, you know, there has to be this imaginative process for the viewer, right? To work out, okay, what's really going on? What does this mean? And so allegory invites some kind of reflective engagement, right? And I think actually in terms of communicating these difficult but important themes to kids, that's going to be a lot more effective and a lot more interesting. I think it treats kids as more intelligent viewers as well. And, you know, I think kids are intelligent viewers. And so I think most kids watching this will be able to work out what's going on. And by the end of it, we'll sort of understand what this was about.
Yeah. And I think, yeah, I think it definitely... I think it definitely shows the very, like, the how that kind of transition of a relationship sort of becoming abusive, like, and
well, the episode gives enough time to show the slow drift, right?
Yeah, and that it is sort of charming at first, but then that sort of gradually goes sour.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I was a big fan, I say fan, I was very impressed with the Home Office's This Is Abuse campaign from a few years ago, which I thought was very effective. It showed before some films for teenagers. And I think they were very good and very hard-hitting. But yes, because of their length, you know, they were just tiny microfilms. They could only focus on moments, right? And that's good too. But yeah, I do think the power of something like this, where you've got, you know, half an hour or so to open up a narrative, means that, yeah, you can really show it as a process, right?
Mm.
So yeah, I thought it was actually... quite powerful, although yeah. Not without its moments of comedy, I have to admit.
Yeah.
As I say, there's a curious bit which my sister found very funny. I don't know. I don't know if it's something about how the phone spoke, but there's a bit where Marty sees, I suppose, Kim talking to another boy and goes, "Ah, in front of my eyes." Kind of like the enraged robot radio we were talking about with Paper House last week. Phoebe said it reminded her of something Eric Cartman might say in South Park. In front of my ass.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely something kind of funny about this very angry but in like phone. It's just
well, I think on one in terms of technology, I think, you know, that is also quite relatable, because, like, you know, I do the Wii Fit, and I'm not trying to say that the Wii Fit is emotionally abusive, but it does sometimes feel like it's been rather designed to make you feel bad. like when you step on it, it goes ow. Oh, okay, thanks. And then, like, if you don't use it for a while, it's like, you know, where have you been? Okay. And then, like, it'll do these sort of really passive aggressive things. Like, one time I didn't use it for a couple of weeks, and I went on it and it was like, It's been a while. Phoebe! And it's like, it knows I'm not Phoebe. I've put my username in. There's no way it was genuinely mistaken, right? So all that was a dig at me for not having used it for a while.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, I don't use... Siri. Because, I don't know. I mean, I do like her tendency to laugh inexplicably at random moments. that's pretty good. But it's quite fun when you go around someone's house and they've got Siri, because you can just have endless fights commandeering the music system.
Oh.
Because you can just go, you know, Siri, play Stairway to Heaven. And then someone will go, no, Siri, play Beethoven's Fifth. No, Siri, play Taylor Swift. Volume 10, volume naught, you know. This happened last time I went round my friend Lewis's.
Speaking of music on a phone.
Bravery badge.
Bravery badge. Do you want to talk about bravery badge?
Maybe to a degree, but I hated scouts. You know, so Bravery Badge is like a scouts-like organisation, and
yeah,
I might have said this before, but the only reason I went to Beavers, Cubs, Scouts, then Explorers, the only reason I stayed in the movement after Beavers, which I enjoyed because Beavers was legitimately fun, was because you take that awful pledge to God and the Queen.
Oh,
right. So yeah, so you say, you know, I pledged to God and the Queen to uphold the Scout Cub code and something like that, right? And so I thought, yeah, if I left the organisation, that would be the double whammy of both treason and blasphemy.
Oh no. Yeah,
exactly. And I was like, phew, I don't want to risk that one, you know, upsetting God and the Queen in one. Oh, now that is too rich for my blood. I just stayed in the movement out of fear.
You just suffered through.
Yeah, I hated it. Having OCD, I really couldn't stand camping. Like, you know, not having a proper toilet, having to wee outside was awful. I still can't do knots. Like, I think the only thing I really enjoyed was like the backwoods cooking, which for a long, long time I thought was backwards cooking. like I only realised a couple of years ago that it was in the back of the woods. Like, I thought it was because it was called backwards cooking because it wasn't very good. you're doing it backwards. Like rubbish cooking. I don't know. But, you know, I enjoyed that. You could, you know, wrap up a banana in tin foil, put it in with chocolate, put it on the bonfire. That was good. But, yeah. I got a lot of the badges. You know, I was very dedicated. Motivated by fear and obedience to the Lord and the Queen rather than actual enjoyment. So your bravery badge focuses on a character who also doesn't like this outdoors organisation she's forced to be a member of, albeit she's just too cool for it, really, and cynical. So she's not like I was as a kid, you know, she's not going along out of fear, but she hates it too. And she's very cynical about the whole thing. And so they've gone out into these woods on a camping expedition, and the leader tells them kind of, you know, typical creepy story around the fire about how a previous troop of kids have gone to these woods and gotten lost and never appeared. And, you know, a lot of the kids are scared, but our main character's like, yeah, for sure. But then the kids do start disappearing. And it turns out that, well, there's something uncanny in nature itself, that spores of sorts, or they might be some kind of alien organism, it's never, like, kind of clarified, but are being released from these plants. And, you know, those spores that commandeer ants' brains.
Oh yes, yeah, it's very much like those. I mean, they don't burst out of the campers' heads, but
can you remember how these spores with the ants work?
They end up, I don't know, inside the ants somehow.
Yes, yeah, so I guess
they eat them, are they?
And then
ingest them somehow, and then they grow and
they infiltrate the ant's brain.
Yeah, and burst out on the top of their heads.
Yeah, I think they commandeer the ant and its nervous system and get the ant to climb to the top of the tip of a stalk of grass.
What? I'd forgotten this.
Yeah, in order to spread the spore over as large a surface area as possible.
Oh, wow.
So the ant climbs its way up and then it bursts out the top of the ant's head.
Yeah, it's a David Attenborough one, isn't it?
Yeah, David Attenborough's horror show.
So these spores are kind of crawl into the camper's ears, and kind of infect them with this music.
Yeah, this sort of this Ring of Roses.
Creepy lullaby. Yeah.
So they become zombie-like kind of characters, I guess. And they
have this... They all have this sort of horribly vacant smile.
Yeah, this rictus grin.
which all of the actors do incredibly well.
Yeah, especially the scout leader.
Yeah, yeah. Because they're sort of running away, and they see this scout leader, and then she turns around and she has this expression on her face.
Yes, Elizabeth Bower. I've written down Kubrick's Grin of Evil, because Stanley Kubrick, like, Shining and Full Metal Jacket. You know, he always has this moment where a character has this awful leering grin, and she was doing the Kubrick grin. It was great.
Yeah. And they're sort of lurching along and sort of humming this tune, and it eventually takes over all of them except the main character. She's running through the woods, and then she finds that, because she's listening to super heavy music on her headphones the whole time, that she finds that this repels the people who are infected with the spores.
It's true, because flowers hate metal.
So she starts sort of taking off her headphones and blasting music, and the people sort of curl up in pain as the spores sort of wither and die and wriggle out of their ears.
it made me think of the kind of sentient version of the Gunge you used to get in 90s TV shows like Get Your Own Back.
Yeah, it's pretty Gungy. Mm. And then, right at the end, the first person who disappears, sort of, so they've kind of rescued the rest of the troop by blasting this music at them. And then the first person reappears, and she's found the old scout, the original troop, who disappeared in the 80s. in their 30s and 40s. So, lurching along.
You wonder what kind of life they've made for themselves in the woods.
You do, yeah. Just been... Yeah.
Photosynthesizing.
Wandering around the woods for 30 years.
Yeah, I found this one of the creepiest or one of the scariest of the series. And I watched some of the kids react to videos on CBeebies online. And this seemed to be the one that creeped out the most kids.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely, it's pretty creepy. The suspense of you don't know when people are going to turn, and sort of, they have to, you know, the kind of zombie movie thing of the friends becoming infected and then having to run away from them, and the group dwindling.
And I'm sure, I'm sure Blake and Butler are well aware, it neatly literalises the term earworm.
it's obviously like another interesting word in relation to technology, because it's very much it's their phones that save them in the end. And there's an image of them all holding up their phones, playing music at the troop that have reappeared to to kill off the spores.
So a happier ending than slapstick.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I mean, it perhaps would have been a bit too downbeat after all that, if it had ended on a more defeatist note. The episode that also scared me a lot was Cat Food. Which involves a kind of Ferris Bueller-style obnoxious kid who fakes being ill, but ends up like Bart in Bart After Dark. You know, the Simpsons episode where Bart breaks his letter, he ends up spying on Ned Flanders with his telescope through the window. Yeah, it sort of ends up like this. So, you know, the kid spends his time looking out the window and then sees this old lady up to very suspicious activities, and she turns out to be something akin to the Grinny. So a demonic alien old lady from folklore who bathes herself in cat food, which seemed to be sort of one-upping the comic relief baked beans challenge, I thought.
But mostly
I like this one for the just pitch-perfect casting of the elderly lady. Because I've written down, I don't mean this to be cruel, so I've written in brackets Jim Broadbent face. And what...
Oh, no.
Mm. So what I mean by that, I don't mean that she looks exactly like Jim Broadbent, but I find Jim Broadbent very disturbing, if I'm honest. And I'm sure he seems like, you know, a pretty decent human being, but especially when he's in roles which require him to be disturbing, like Moulin Rouge. So.
His face just sort of turns into sort of evil putty.
Yes, evil putty face. Precisely. It just looks too soft.
Mm.
Like, there's something, I don't know, soft and slack and...
Just me and my little knife. So it's Brazil again.
But I do think that just something about his face that, you know, he looks like a kind old man, but actually...
Yeah.
So if they can get Jim Broadbent for the next season... That would be ace.
Yes. Yes, definitely. And sort of the idea, the old lady, so it's a kind of parasitic host type deal, where she has to find a new body to inhabit, to keep herself alive.
Yes, kind of like Being John Malkovich, which is one of my favourite films. So.
Yeah, like Being John Malkovich, we're making lots of references to this episode, but it's fine. a creepy and non-consensual version of The Trill in Star Trek.
Yeah. or a little bit like The Ancestor, which is a very creepy Junji Ito comic. Manga. But in that one, each ancestor somehow remains joined at the skull to each preceding ancestor, so they end up as a ridiculous ancestral worm, like joined, like each skull, like sort of sliced off.
Yeah, wow. So yeah, there's quite a few parasitic body swapping stories out there.
But so what's the episode you found scariest?
I think it's possibly Kindlesticks.
It's a great title.
Which is a great title. I just I really enjoyed this episode, and it just has a great twist at the end. So Kindlesticks is about Esme, who is a sort of proudly terrible babysitter, whose shtick is that she terrifies kids she sits for into submission by telling them a story about the Night-Night Man. And then just at the sort of critical bit of the story, she has her friend burst through the door, sort of covered in leaves, pretending to be the Night-Night Man and chasing the kids to their beds so she can have the house to herself for the evening. And she's been doing this pretty successfully for a while. And she babysits her kid called Ashley, who is not only sort of not scared by her Night-Night Man antics, but tells her that she's going to be punished by a figure called Kindlesticks for being mean to kids. So sort of various uncanny things start happening in the house, and Ashley tells her that it's Kindlesticks, sort of the her friend who she's sort of trying to seduce, I guess. It's scared out of the house, and Kindlesticks ends up sort of showing her pictures of the kids that she sat for in tears, and like, you know, this is what you did. Kind of chasing her around the house, objects flying everywhere. She sort of huddles in a cupboard with Ashley, who's then sort of taken by Kindlesticks, and she's sort of hiding in this closet by herself, and this sort of red eyes approaching from above her. And then the lights turn on, and it turns out that it's Ashley, just sort of with some torches and a big coat. And she's like, oh, it was you all along. Oh, I learned my lesson, sort of thing.
But do you want to say what the twist is?
But the twist is that when the parents come home, it's an interesting androgynous name twist. Ashley, she's been asleep all night, and she's like, Ashley's a girl. And goes into the room, and there's like Ashley asleep in the bed, and it's like a little girl. It's not the figure who she's been seeing all night. Like, wait, that's Ashley. And then she runs out of the room, and on the stairs there's the kid who we've been seeing, who is Kindlesticks, and his eyes glow red. It was very enjoyable. I did like that.
Yeah, it's quite a ghoulish episode.
Yeah.
I like that the Kindlesticks kid seems to be dressed up like Max from Where the Wild Things Are.
Mm.
Like in his romping suit.
Yeah.
I think it's the episode that reminded me the most of the Goosebumps TV series. Actually, I thought it had quite Goosebumpsy acting, generally. The sort of dynamic and slightly flamboyant, like, cinematography. Like, I've noted here that a bin gets a POV shot at one point. I'm very much in favour of inanimate objects being given point of view shots in films. Yeah, I mean, effectively, it plays out like a haunted house episode or film. It's quite episodic. It has quite stop-start rhythms, but I think because it keeps you on your toes so much, it doesn't really matter. You're very much waiting for the next thing to pop out.
And it's very, very clear moral in that one.
Yes, that's true. Don't be a babysitter. Some kids are tougher than they look. So if you're
and there's a creepy guardian of children who might punish you.
Yeah.
If you.
So only bully the kids that.
Only bully the smallest.
Yes, I only bully the smallest kids. No, I'm scared. Don't write in and complain, parents.
Don't bully any kids.
Not even if your Kindle sticks. Because he's a protector of kids. Let's do texture of the week.
Texture of the week.
I'm gonna have to start buying instruments.
Yeah.
Kids ones like a toy tambourine. I guess my texture was going to be the gunk from Bravery Badge. I liked how it seemed kind of gelatinous but insectoid at the same time. Quite Cronenberg-y.
Yeah.
How about you?
I don't know. I sort of struggled to find one this week. Even though it's odd, as there definitely are good textures. I've decided on the baby tangled up in seaweed.
Oh, yes.
From the episode The Call, which we haven't mentioned, which is about sirens. That they find the main characters a baby on a beach, and it's all just sort of tangled up in a patch of seaweed, which I quite enjoyed. And possibly also Jessie's mum in Slapstick sort of sticking marshmallows into her mouth robotically.
Oh, yes.
Filling her cheeks with marshmallows.
Fuzzy bunny. Yeah. Possibly the nose of the bully in Trolled.
Ah, so I haven't seen that one.
So it's about, well... It literalises the title, so internet troll becomes a troll. This happens gradually, and at first his nose just swells up to a ginormous size, and looks, I guess, very troll-like. That one isn't the strongest. I thought it was a little bit pat. Like perhaps just the metaphor's too literal, possibly. Mm-hmm. I liked the sort of focus on the potential horrors of puberty. You know, body transformation is generally effective in kids' horror. But there was a potential towards, like, using facial deformities as a site of horror, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it felt a bit like an episode of Round the Twist, but without perhaps the charm. I think Round the Twist could get very grotesque, right? Like, it was pretty gross out, like, rewatching bits of Round the Twist. But I think it kind of got away with it because it has a lot of charming characters. So even though, it has some icky stuff like the spaghetti, I always remember there's that episode where there's a TV remote that actually controls time, and then there's a spaghetti eating contest which is put into reverse.
Oh, yeah.
And so someone had, yeah. And, I mean, anyone, even OCD or not, I think, would find that pretty nauseating.
Yeah.
And some of the episodes are sort of more sentimental than others, albeit sometimes effectively. A Boy Called Red is quite good, and actually reminded me quite a lot of William Sleezer. And sort of, you know, brought up feelings for me around my father. So it's sort of about, you know, a kid befriending his own father when they were a kid, through time travel means. I think it's important to sometimes remember that your parents were children too, and try to imagine them as children.
Hmm.
I think this is a healthy activity.
I think, yeah, the series definitely did a good job of showing how horrible it is to be 13. Or around that age.
Yeah, which I think is what you want in kids' horror. You know, you want something that feels empathetic, but creepy at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah, you have any other...
No, just that it's thoroughly recommended, really. And, you know, I made a BuzzFeed post giving reasons why it's better than Black Mirror. And, you know, they're slightly tongue-in-cheek, but I genuinely do enjoy it more than Black Mirror. Like, Black Mirror, there are individual episodes I've liked very much. But I just find the cynicism exhausting. You know, I find the kind of relentlessness of its pessimism, it just kind of wears me out, and sometimes it feels a bit pleased with itself. So I'm very fond of Charlie Brooker, so I don't want to be too disparaging, but the last season I just found a bit heavy going, and I don't know, whereas I think, you know, yeah, Creeped Out's a kid's show, but I think it does a better job at balancing horror with a basic belief in human beings' potential for kindness and compassion.
Yeah.
Any last thoughts?
I think Punch and Judy is a great source of horror.
Oh, well, yeah, undoubtedly so.
Yes, all for things that mind that particular frightening vein.
So you're hoping for a future episode about a terrible crocodile who steals some sausages?
Yes. Our intro music's by Maki Yamazaki, our outro music's by Jay Kelly, our artwork's by Letty Wilson. Give all their details in the show notes. You can find us on Twitter at stillscaredpod, or email us at stillscaredpodcast@gmail.com. Do you have a sign?
Gosh, every time.
Sorry.
This is how you sign off, and that's the way to do it.
That's the way to do it, creepy kids.
Yeah, that's the way to do it, creepy kids.
See you next time.
Bye.